Last year, the Iditarod went to the next generation. In 40 years, how many generations of dogs have there been? Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. It's still about the dogs, the real athletes of the Iditarod Trail sled dog race, but it's the mushers who keep the kennels and set the strategy. Our statewide phone number, 1-800-478-8255, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422, email talk@alaskapublic.org. We're talking Iditarod again this year on Talk of Alaska statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by First National Bank Alaska, offering business solutions to help Alaska's dreams grow for 90 years. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Last time I checked, and I'll find out for sure tomorrow, we were down to, I guess, about 66 teams still signed up for this year's Iditarod. That's down a bit. And the race keeps changing. It keeps evolving. The sponsorship dynamics change. The money scramble is different. And the trail, of course, is different every year. So here we are again. Let's take a look at the race that's coming up to start this weekend. Joining me on Talk of Alaska, along with the people of Alaska who call this show at 1-800-478-8255 from around the state or in Anchorage at 550-8422, is Zach Steer, a dog musher, a lodge proprietor, and he's, in fact, joining us by telephone from the Sheep Mountain Lodge. Zach, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Yeah, good morning, Steve. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing pretty good. I always love doing this show. This is one of my favorites because it's a show that just makes itself, and there's so much to learn about this. You would think we would have exhausted the subject after 40 years, but that's not really true because everything keeps changing.
So everything is different every year. It's just like the trail changes every year. You know, the mushers come back because it's not the same race each year, and that's why we love to talk about it.
Yeah, I see that Donlin Creek has once again signed on as a major sponsor of the race, and of course they are interested in getting a power line right of way through Rainy Pass. I brought this up last week, and the mushers I talked to said, well, you know, the race keeps changing. I'm not really opposed to straightening out some of that gnarly stuff up there. How would you feel about that? How do you feel about maybe, you know, if you had a power line right of way, it might really take away some of those nasty kinks?
Well, you know, you look at a lot of the sections of the trail. I mean, we follow old mining roads, all old mining trails already, and I don't see it as a big, you know, a big change. You know, you hate to bypass historically, you might call it fun sections of the trail, like the Dalzell Gorge or the Happy Canyon Steps. But the race is dynamic, and it does change, and usually the hardest part is just adapting to that change. So I'm not opposed to something like that, as long as it's not going to, you know, significantly affect the race. And I don't think something like that would.
So you got into the business in 1989. I did ride mushing, but you haven't run lately.
No, 98, actually, was
98,
my first
sorry.
Race. Yeah, so been about 15 years. And I've done six Iditarods, and, you know, I'm not a full-time professional musher. I've got a day job here at the lodge, so that keeps me pretty busy. But I like to stay involved as a volunteer, and I help other teams training, and of course, as a spectator. And I'm really enjoying that role now this year.
And then you kind of ginned up your own race up there, a qualifying race.
Well, yeah, you know, I was running on these trails around Sheep Mountain in Eureka area, and we've got a great trail system up here, and it was the ones that I was using for my dog training, and it was just a way for me to share those trails with other mushers, and it sort of morphed into a qualifying race for Iditarod. And in fact, this spring we're going to be having a 200 and a 300-mile race in March and use that as qualification for mushers trying to do Iditarod and maybe Yukon Quest too.
Wow. So sometimes your race doesn't come off, I've noticed.
Well, yeah, our batting average isn't so good because I really try to have the race early in the year. And as you know, with Alaskan weather, one year, you know, you got more snow than you know what to do with, and the next year we don't have enough. And having the race early December is great logistically, time-wise for me, but Mother Nature doesn't always want to cooperate that time of the year. So I think a move to the springtime is a better move in the long run.
So it would run then, you say March, it would be after the Iditarod or before? I mean, it can't be before, really.
No, it can't be before, and it really can't be during. There's a real need, I think, for a lot of the future generation of dog mushers to have a race that they can do after the Iditarod while there's still snow on the ground that's on the road system, and that right now doesn't exist. And there's a lot of dog handlers, there's a lot of spouses that, you know, they watch their team that they trained all winter take off on Iditarod, and sometimes those dogs come back to the kennel after they've been in Nome, and their season's done. But, you know, why waste a perfectly well-trained team and when you have good trail conditions in March? You know, springtime can be the best time of the year in Alaska.
Oh, I guess you wouldn't threaten the Kobuk 440. You'd still come in before that.
They're into April. You know, they can hold their snow a little bit longer, so it doesn't really overlap with the Kobuk. There's one race over in Dawson that we're going to overlap with a little bit, but that tends to attract more local mushers. I'm looking to get just South Central Alaskan mushers who maybe want to be thinking about next year's Iditarod or Yukon Quest while they have the dogs ready and get them on the trail.
Well, Zach Steer, that sounds like a great idea.
Yeah, so yeah. It should be fun, and people can come out and watch, and it's a weekday event because it gets kind of busy up here in the spring with snow machiners. So we plan our dog sled races where we try to have as minimal conflict with, you know, snow machiners and poker runs and all sorts of fun activities that Alaskans like to do in the spring.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It's so, just like the big activity that's coming up this weekend. It's I call it the world's longest bonfire camp out tailgate party for 100 miles all the way to Skwentna, just about every bend of the river. You know, you're going to see Alaskans at their finest.
You know, it's all that flavor that's difficult to convey in a news story. Because it's not really news.
It's not new. You know, they really need to make it into a reality TV show, because if the film crew went out and it just ignored the sled dog race that was going on and just focused on the party that went on for that first 100 miles to Skwentna, there's a whole season's worth of episodes going on there, I tell you what.
Well, it used to. I remember we used to get our own pilot, or we would share a pilot, usually try and find somebody to share a pilot with. But the pilots found other clients, basically, and the price went up because it turned out that there were a bunch of rich people that were willing to, you know, just be flown around following the Iditarod.
Oh, it's fun. I mean, it's just a crazy circus-like atmosphere. You know, people, anybody with a snow machine and an airplane, if it's a bluebird day, you're going to see them out there. You know, on the first couple miles, you see any sort of motorized equipment out there. I've seen guys driving their lawn tractors in the wintertime on the trail. You see guys with airboats buzzing around on the snow. You know, just everyone's having a good time and a safe, you know, party-like atmosphere. But, you know, it does all revolve around the dogs, and that's the focus of the attention. And it's just such a fun time. And that's a big part of the Iditarod, you know, beyond the actual race itself.
You know, there's some strange things about this year's race, and one of them is the return of Robert Bunsen, who I understand is working with you.
Yeah, we've been a kennel partners for 15 years. I actually started off as a dog handler for him. I was helping him in the 97 race, and he handed me the reins to his team in 98, and so we've worked together ever since then.
And so what did the lodge clients ever complain about the dog sound at feeding time?
Well, you know, it... For every one complaint I get, I probably get about 50 compliments. You know, people, and so I got to take that in stride. I figure that's about the same ratio I have in the restaurant with the food, so it can't be that bad.
Oh.
You know, people come here, and when you go to an Alaska lodge, you want to see the sled dogs out back. You want to see the snow machine and the skis and that kind of stuff. So I think it's something that enhances the lodge atmosphere.
So you, in going into the lodge business, you haven't sullied the reputation of the Sheep Mountain Lodge food?
No, I haven't, nor of the sport of sled dog mushing.
Let's go to Ann, joins the program from Connecticut. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Ann.
Yes, thank you. I want to say that my family and I don't see anything wrong with short races, but this marathon race of the Iditarod pushes the dogs beyond their limits. I understand that there's 66 mushers entered this year, with 16 dogs each, starting out over 1,000 dogs. And I know that only about half of them make it to the finish line. They're racing these dogs over 100 miles a day and up to about 14 days. And I don't know why anybody would want to do this to a dog. I certainly wouldn't want to do that to my dog. And people see this as cruelty to animals.
Well, Ann, I'd say your dog probably wouldn't want to do it, but maybe these dogs are a little different. I will say I appreciate you taking the position that you've taken, and of course, you'll prompt a lot of response calls. So I'm grateful to you for that. You're certainly not the only person that feels that this is cruel to the dogs.
Well, I know there are organizations, the Animal Legal Defense Fund, In Defense of Animals, and other organizations that want to see this race stopped. I don't know. It shouldn't have ever started. When you're pushing dogs, I mean, I understand these dogs are at the end of a chain when they're not racing or training, a short chain, and the chain is attached to their small dog enclosure.
All right.
And
yeah.
That's their life. It's either at the end of a chain attached to their enclosure, or they're racing or training. And this is no way to treat a dog. What kind of a life is this for a dog?
I'm getting your point, Ann, and I want to thank you for your call. And you could stay on. I'll ask Zach Steer if he'd like to respond at all.
Well, we hear that side of the argument a lot, and I can only say that, and I would hope that you would get to, if you could come to Alaska and see this for yourself, and see the dogs in action, see the type of dogs that we're using, which is often a misconception, and see, the care and the attention and the level of compassion that the mushers do have for their dogs. If you can see that firsthand, usually that's all it takes to have a different opinion.
Well, what about this matter of the short chains, though, that she brought up?
Well, we do tend to chain our dogs during the summer season, during the off season, as a form of kennel management. If you have too many dogs in a small area, eventually you're going to end up with dog fights or misbreedings.
Oh, you're really asking for trouble.
Getting loose. I mean, it's worse than a classroom full of kids, and it's the safest way for us to keep our dogs under good management. Most mushers can let their dogs off the chain and they'll be fine, and half the time the dogs run back to their houses. That's their comfort area, even when they're not on the chain. But for good kennel management, that's what we've found is to be the safest, most humane way to take care of our dogs.
But what about Ann's point that what kind of life is that?
Well, I would say that these dogs get out and see more country, more of Alaska. They're more socialized than most people's dogs. I mean, my dogs, I can only speak from my personal experience, are so used to being around strange dogs, strange people, strange environments, because they see that all the time. It's like they don't ever get phased. They're used to helicopters, airplanes taking off over their head, and it's just it's all in a day's work for them. And that's something that most dogs don't get to, experience or enjoy.
All right. Thanks for your the civility of your response there, Zach Steer. Ann, anything you want to add?
Yeah, I like to bring to the attention, if people don't know this, over 140 dogs have died that we know about, that records have been kept for. And why put a dog through this? It's a dangerous, it's called it's a dangerous race. They're put through all kinds of weather and conditions, and they're just pushed beyond their limits. I mean, two dogs could have died last year. They were revived, but they dropped dead in their tracks. This is really no way to treat a dog, and there's no good reason for it. They're not going to rush to get serum to people. There's just no good reason except for money.
Well, it's definitely a sport, but I have to disagree with you about the money part of it, Ann. Thanks for your call. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Yeah. Let's go to Steve, joins the program from Willow. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Steve.
Hey, Steve. Thanks so much for having me on the show. This is my favorite show all week, and I'd like to commend Ann for her honesty, and I feel she's a beautiful Alaskan. This is the state. This is the way our state needs to move.
Well, she's from... wait a second. Steve. Enough of that. Steve, you got to... When I interrupt you, I'm interrupting you. You can't just keep talking. It's going to sound crappy. Now, do you still have him on? All right, Steve. She's from Connecticut. All right, now go ahead.
Okay, I'm sorry. I would like to speak to Zach as to one dog in particular, and that's Topaz. Do you remember dog Topaz?
Yeah, he was a dog I had in my kennel. He was probably born in 2000, something like that.
Well, Zach, I'm a homesteader in Lowell. I've been here 8 years. I worked at the Tell River Lodge where you did, and I wanted to be a musher at one point, but this dog, Topaz, changed my life. And I rescued him in 20 below zero from Gary Paulson's lot, and he was in a catatonic state in the dead of winter, lacerated. He couldn't walk. His rear hips were frozen. My wife brought him home against my wishes, and it forever changed my life in Alaska. It forever changed who I am as a person. And I do agree with Ann. It is not an isolated injury. I witness it. Even though 140 dogs died on record, thousands of them die the next day and are unreported. Maybe not thousands, but 140 additional could die after the race and go unreported. That 140 is only at the race. So I just wanted to point out one dog in particular that you have a history with that wound up on someone else's lot, and this is not an isolated situation in Alaska. I feel these dogs are bred for the race, and they wind up, you know, when they are not in athletic form anymore, they are moved on to a different condition, and that is, you know, like if you're a peewee football player, you have an A team, a B team, and a C team. Well, these dogs get on the C team lot, and they're not mushing anymore.
All right, Steve. All right. Thank you, Steve. That's quite an attack, and I think Zach deserves a response on that.
Well, This is news to me, but I can tell you, it is common for mushers to buy and sell and to lease dogs and to trade dogs, and you know, within my realm of responsibility, I can control what happens in my kennel. You know, when I trust, you know, somebody else, when I sell a dog to somebody else, I'm entrusting the health and well-being of that dog to the next musher, but I can't always guarantee, you know, a perfect outcome or what I would do, and so like I said, this is a new story to me, and it's not an outcome that I would choose, and that if I was aware of, you know, beforehand, it's not something I would ever do. So it's just, like I said, that is new to me.
Thank you for that. I'm sorry to blindside you with that, Zach, because that's a tough one. I mean, if it was my dog, I was in your position, I my emotion would be pretty great right now.
Yeah, I mean, I know the dog. That dog used to belong to me, but I don't know the end result of every dog down the line. So that's all I can say to that matter.
Yeah. Stephen Willow, I want to thank you for your call. Our telephone number is 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. We're talking about the Iditarod and its changes, and our guest is Zach Steer, a musher and lodge proprietor and a great fan of the sport. And, you know, I've had two calls now, Zach, of people basically with, you know, feeling that this sport shouldn't exist, that it's cruel to the animal. Some people have talked about that it would be more humane to convert the Iditarod at some point into some kind of a stage race so that there would not be the stress, so much stress on the dogs.
Yeah, I mean, there's been talk of that. There's all sorts of different formats of sled dog racing, and, you know, I don't think there's a perfect format. I mean, there's been some dog deaths in some shorter mid-distance races this year. Some of those dogs did die in the beginning stages of the race, so I don't think changing distances is the effective way to treat that problem. And it has been a problem, and it's something that Mushers and the Iditarod especially is addressing. I mean, the Iditarod has gone 3 years straight without a dog death, and that is an achievement that it's not a matter of luck. 1 year is luck, 2 years maybe, but 3 years means you've got protocols in place, you've got veterinary care that's been brought to a new level, you've got science working on your side, that you're constantly striving for improvement, and the results are showing. Will the Iditarod be dog death-free forever? I doubt it. You know, that's something that's going to happen, but it's, you know, no dog's going to die in vain, and it's something that no musher wants, but it is a part of the sport. But it's not a part that we want, you know, that we're always trying to minimize. We're trying to minimize that risk, but it's a sport that has risk.
You worked with a veterinarian. In fact, we had him on our program at one point, and it was a revelation when he described to us what a frontier the Iditarod is for veterinarians. These animals are capable of things that they didn't know were possible.
Well, that's right. I mean, they've used the sled dogs in their training and in the racing, you know, as, you know, to study, to sort of see what sort of metabolic changes the dogs go through, what sort of muscular differences, what things can we learn from the dogs that we can maybe even apply to people, you know, that the dogs are able to adapt. And the dog's physiology, what we've found, is just off the charts. They're just incredible athletes. Their ability to work efficiently, relatively effortlessly, for long periods of time is unparalleled. I mean, they're really some of the most efficient athletes in the world. I would say way more athletic than people, that's for sure.
One of our shows about the Iditarod, we had Ted Carasotti on. I don't know if you're acquainted with his work at all, but he wrote about his dog Merle, and he became quite the crusader for proper geriatric care for aging dogs. And his whole lesson with Merle was that Merle was smarter than he was, and that he learned so much from this dog, and it's a huge bestseller. And a very powerful book, and it brought to mind a scientist I was listening to, a Japanese guy, who is researching the intelligence level of chimpanzees, and he has a situation where they are not coerced in any way, but they are in captivity, and if they choose to, they can participate in this experiment, which consists of punching points on the screen to get the proper numerical order. They have to punch one and then number two and number three and like that. And his finding is they can do this way faster than people can.
Mm-hmm.
Vastly faster. And with a shorter exposure time to the numbers on the screen. This is a fact. And I think in many ways, I mean, maybe we're not thinking about animals in the best way. We're either anthropomorphizing or whatever, but they are in realms that we're not in. And I think anyone who has to run a dog lot knows this.
Yeah. No, I mean, when you go out on training runs and when you see what the dogs can do, and then when you can see what they can do when they're in, you know, extreme conditions, like when they are running in the Iditarod or the Yukon Quest, you know, most mushers, most spectators, most people, you know, intimately involved with the sport have nothing but awe for the animals. And, I mean, there's no better way to say it. They're just incredible.
Let's go to Kristen, joins the program from Finger Lake. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Kristen.
Yeah, hi, thanks. My name's Kirsten Dixon.
Hi, Kirsten.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
Kirsten.
Hey, so my husband, Carl, and I have been proud participants with the Iditarod for the past 20 years that we've lived at the location of the Finger Lake checkpoint. We live at a place called Winter Lake Lodge, and we have 22 sled dogs that we dearly love and really feel have enriched our lives and our children's lives living there. Last year, we were startled in the night by a rumbling sound and headlights, and we realized there were actually earth-moving equipment and vehicles traveling quite close to us. Now, we are, we're mile 198 along the Iditarod, and really we had always sort of proudly said the closest nearest road to us is Anchorage, and I'm not really sure I can completely say that anymore. We have a very beautiful meadow behind our lodge that we love to take our dogs into, the perfectly beautiful glistening meadow. And now, last winter, it was sort of plowed through by this heavy equipment that created an ice road to go up towards Rainy Pass and the, idea of future road development. And trees were just mowed over like Godzilla had come through our valley. I know that doesn't mean much in the big scheme of, money and power and extraction of minerals from the earth, but it means everything to us. And so how our lives change in the future, how the Iditarod changes, how our neighborhood changes. A gold company has come into my little corner of the valley and have renamed all the mountains near us with new names, with names of Canadian names. And this is a place that we deeply love. We've invested our entire lives in living there, and change is coming, but it's not without a cost.
Kirsten, that is really something. This is getting out of the realm of this program probably because it needs its own show for sure. But it's definitely, development is creeping up from the Parks Highway, isn't it?
Well, I think, we Alaskans all love Alaska, and we all understand the need for economic development. In terms of my particular business, guests come to stay with me to see the natural beauty and the wildness in that country of Alaska, and they won't come to see a power line.
Thanks, Kirsten. Thanks for your call.
Thanks. Bye.
From Finger Lake, and now from Denali, Jeff King joins us. Jeff, welcome to Talk of Alaska. Glad you called.
Good morning. Yeah, welcome back.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me on. I just wanted to call all my competitors and fans and villages across Alaska and tell them Iditarod week's coming up, and we're really looking forward to it. It's sure a big part of our life.
Yeah, Jeff, anything you want to say to Zach?
Oh, Zach is a longtime friend of mine, as is Kirsten. It's great to hear. It's such a big state and yet so small. Zach is a pillar in our community for sure, and his ability to manage a kennel, manage a race, manage a family, manage a business. He's top shelf. And I look forward to him getting Robert the team next year, is my guess, him or his wife.
And Zach?
Yeah, well, I look forward to being back on the trail someday again, but I don't know if I look forward to racing Jeff, because he's still darn tough out there. Keep showing your toes, and he's one of the guys you don't look forward to racing him ahead of time, but when you're out there, he brings out the best in all the guys around him. So that's.
You guys are being way too nice to one another.
Yeah, this is what we do before the race. During the race, it's a whole different story.
Yeah, out of the way, buddy.
No, you know, Jeff.
Years ago, I had one of my Make-A-Wish riders was my Iditarider was a child from Texas, Jacqueline Yonkers from Texas, and she was so excited about the Iditarod and her ride with me, and we were excited for her. But one of my fondest memories is that non-competitive stroll through the Tudor bike trails on the way out to Campbell Creek. And we did catch and pass a team that was stopping to visit with people along the way or moving slower. And as we went around, my little rider leaned out and yelled, "See ya, suckers!" And it's been a fond memory ever since. But the competition is good-natured. I think one of my favorite photos, and gosh, if you can imagine my nearing 40 years on a dog sled, one of my favorite photos is during that ceremonial start of the race with Lance Mackey holding a big tree, taking on a moose to protect his dogs. I've been on the trail for a long time. I know some wonderful people, and you see Lance. I remember one time Vern Halter was all but risking his life to make sure his dogs were safe on top of Eagle Summit in a tough situation, and seeing Lance go after that moose with his tree is just etched in my memory.
Well, Jeff King, I wish you well in this year's race.
Yeah, well, we're looking forward to a great race. I got an awesome team and a fabulous sled and an outstanding crew back home. So we're looking out for an awesome event. And my best to everybody.
All right. Thanks a lot. It's
I think what Jeff said about the race drawn together all these different places is really paramount to the event. It's what does Shaktulik have to do with Takotna or have to do with Rainy Pass, and for that 10 days of the race when they're all connected on that line, and, they've all got this common goal and this common event, and it, as the mushers, we just really, I know I looked forward to seeing these places, especially after you've done it a couple of years. And I can't imagine what it's like for guys like Jeff or Martin or Didi who have been in and out of these villages and small communities 20 or 30 times. And, it's like a homecoming two or three times a day for them. It's really, it's such a fantastic event.
And this year, Rudy Domoski Sr. is in the race, and he first ran it in 1974.
Yeah. Well, we had Dan Seavey last year, who I think was in the original race. And so, we've got new blood, old blood. We've got all sorts of blood in this race. And, there's a story behind every musher and every team.
Zach Steer is our guest on Talk of Alaska as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska, and by Wells Fargo, committed to supporting communities and Alaska residents beyond just their banking needs. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
I remember our Fairbanks reporter, John McWhorter, would cover the Yukon Quest. And then one year he also went to cover the Iditarod, and he said, never again. He said, it's just too big time. It's too big money. And that was in the time when things were changing, right around the turn of the century. It seemed to get to the point where the Iditarod was more about the money than it once was. Zach Steer is with us. That's about the time that he started mushing. Have you seen that trend continue where, you need to get up there in the top 20 because you need that money?
There definitely was a feeling, and I know there was a few years where there was a big push to have a $1 million purse, and then the economy kind of collapsed.
Yeah.
And, dog mushing was no exception. I mean, mushers went out of business. The cost of maintaining a kennel, just feeding your dogs, and let alone doing the race, was cost prohibitive. And so we went from, I think, a top of 97 teams that started the race one year,
And, you know, now we're back down to a more reasonable 50 or 60 teams participating each year. But I think it's back on the upswing a little bit as far as participation. But you're right. And money, I don't think, is the key driver. I've always said you could pay the first place musher $1. You know, if you want to cut their purse, and make the winner $1, and I bet you they'll try just as hard to get to Nome in first place.
Oh, they're not going to let you on the rules committee, I'll tell you that right
now. No, the mushers never like that suggestion.
Let's go to Shannon, joins the program from Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Shannon.
I did a Iditarod once, and I got to run the quest once around Zach. And I just wanted to say that I think Zach and almost all of those mushers do a fantastic job from what I've seen. And I just think the Iditarod's really special, and we should keep as many connections as we can to traveling on the land in that way. Especially as I watch my kids grow up and learn about computers and that sort of thing.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Zach, you want to say hi to Shannon?
Yeah, I know Shannon. I remember running with her and her husband. She's right. I mean, this winter has been really fun. You know, one of the reasons I'm taking a back seat to dog mush racing, sled dog racing, is, you know, so I can spend more time with my two boys. And this winter, when my kids came up to me and said, "Hey, Dad, can we go dog mushing?" And we just take out, you know, three or four dogs at a time, and I let them take the team all by himself. And, you know, we do a 15-mile run up to the mountains and back. And I got more joy out of that one trip there than I did on, you know, a 10-day trip to Nome. You know, that to me is really what it's all about, is just being out there with the dogs and enjoying ourselves and having fun.
Shannon, you still keep dogs?
We don't have dogs now, but we do try and get our kids out, and we ski more now. But I think teaching them kids to have that connection to the land is just, you know, to be able to travel and be self-sufficient. They aren't skills that you see in school kids as much as, you know, we should, especially given where we live. But I think Iditarod is a fantastic thing, and I wanted to call and support, and I think you made a great choice in having Zach on the radio.
I tried for years. He finally came on.
Yeah.
Must be because it was Lori Townsend asking him instead of me.
There you go. She's awful persuasive.
She is. Let's go to Tammy, joins the program from Homer. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Tammy.
Hi, I'm not a dog mushing person. I'm just a dog lover, and I wanted to make some observations listening to the caller that was concerned about cruelty to dogs. And I wanted to point out a couple observations. The fact that if all these dog mushing dogs were just pets, they probably wouldn't exist because their parents would have been neutered and they wouldn't have had a life. And that being said, I'm pretty concerned about the urban populations of dogs. I'd like to see people have more concern about the dogs who are chained up outside of houses and spend the day stuck in the house, and the family rushes home and pets the dog a couple times. These mushers, from what I've seen, spend a lot of time with their animals, and I'm concerned about a population of dogs that suffer every day, that people don't seem to talk about, because in our American culture we seem to be complacent to that. And so I worry about those dogs. And I guess I'd like to say that my experience with dogs in Alaska over the last 35 years is they love to run. And I personally would like to die doing something I love. So I think that we got to look at the whole spectrum of dogs when we try to pluck out one little thing and say this is bad. But all in all, I'm glad that we all have a choice. I'm not going to have a dog team, but I'm glad people do. So thanks for the program.
Yeah, a good comparison there. Thank you so much for that call, Tammy. Let's go to Dennis, joins the program from Kodiak. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Dennis.
Hi, thanks for having me. It's interesting. I've been writing down notes here as to the direction that this has gone. And without elaborating, like a box of chocolate, you know, and I realize, you know, what contempt prior to investigation is. And this, the essence of this show reminds me what we have in Alaska. I've been here long enough, 18 years, to understand what an Alaskan is. And what this Iditarod does, my brother and I, great relationship, you're out, nothing like the communication. He's down in Woodinville in Washington. Nothing like the excitement, you know, even not being Alaskan, that he gets. There's this special spiritual bond that we have. And we're willing to defend that. That last caller said that really nice, that these dogs wouldn't even exist. I want to break out in an Alaskan zealousy here about what the Iditarod means to me.
And Alaskan zealousy, man. I love it. You get on a roll there, Dennis. Good.
Yeah, I was thinking, wow, I'm listening to the show, standing by to come on. And Jeff King, is Jeff King still on by any chance?
No, he just wanted to drop in and out.
Right on. My brother is a huge fan of his, and it would just be would a neat to say, hey, guess who I talked to today? Anyway, back to my notes, that empathy thing. It's magic what we have, and we are willing to defend it. And it's so commendable that you're willing to give, you know, people who do not have that empathy, who do not have that magic, you know, their words. And then that chuckle and laugh, it comes with that. And it is unfortunate. You know, I want to pull out my Bible and talk about, you know, what we're given the reins over, you know, on this earth. And that's a whole other subject. But to elaborate on the excitement of drawing the people together, holy cow, I love the way your guest described that earlier. And one day when I don't remain a lame, lazy tree surgeon here, I'm going to save up money and come up to Nome, and hopefully my brother will be standing there with me to see the mushers come across that line.
All right. Well, I don't know. I think it's possible to be a dog musher on Kodiak Island, isn't it?
Well, I think it's possible. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And the financial backing here, people in Kodiak, well, I'm sure you know a few. Not only is it a super healthy economy, but they tend to help one another out. I don't know of any offhand, but I remember remember Martin Boozer doing the tour thing, and my friend was a vet here back in '95, and I'm a pretty good sized guy, and I realized, wow, Martin's big thumb up is he's like a jockey, you know?
Yeah.
I could see where his size is a big deal.
And, right.
But it was neat that the stuff that came along with you know, the promotion that these guys do, you know, they. Darcy Stilstra, a friend here in Kodiak, his nephew has a business year-round back on the East Coast, I believe Vermont. It's become, he races the Iditarod House for years, but it has become such a mainstay in his income. And I'll tell you what, people flock to pay whatever he charges at these lodges, you know, to be, to be pulled by the Iditarod dog. It's a nostalgia, you know.
Yeah,
I don't have to elaborate on that, but
yeah, Dennis.
Yeah.
I want to thank you for your call.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right, hey Zach Steer, do you do that? Do you give tourist rides on the sled dog?
You know, that's a whole other beast right there. Is doing the I call it pimping out your dogs. I tend to just keep them just for myself. I'm a little guarded with my sled dogs, but I know, you know, a lot of mushers. You know, you talk about the financial burden of the race. And, you know, there's a lot of people, a lot of competitive Iditarod dog mushers that make their living doing tours and rides and summer glacier tours, et cetera. And they do the dog mushing basically to build a name for themselves or just to, you know, to prove that their dogs belong. But, no, we don't do any tours here at the lodge, not yet.
Shannon joins the program from Kinnick. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Shannon.
Hi, Steve. Hi, Zach.
Hi.
I am very nervous. I've never called your show before, although I've listened every week for a long time.
First time caller, long time listener.
Nope, other way around. Y'all know that, right? I'm sorry. I told you I was nervous. I am an animal lover. I owned a pet care business for 15 years, and right currently I have a rescue sled dog. But what I want to point out to Steve from Willow and to Anne from Connecticut is that sled dogs are a whole different breed of dog than the house pet dogs that so many of us are familiar with. Our sled dog rescue is, she also changed my life like Steve's rescue did, but I admire the mushers so much more now because of the type of breeding that this athlete has. She's not a house pet, although she's treated like one. She is truly an athlete. She loves to run, and we've managed to train her in to fit into our life, and she's managed to train us to fit into her life so that we exercise her with a ball and with chasing the birds in the yard. But the other point that I wanted to make is that animal abuse is not just limited to Alaska sled dogs. Animals are abused all over the place, and what we can do as human beings is try to take care of those abused animals that cross our path.
Shannon, thank you. Thank you for that. That's almost like Ted Carasotti's Merle story. Yeah, thank you. Zach, you let your dogs in the house?
Oh, they find their way to the couch every once in a while, that's for sure.
They
don't mind it, for sure, yeah. We, I share a kennel with Robert Bunsen, and so we tend to have the racing dogs usually either at his place or my place, and then the other guy gets all the B team, the C team, the old dogs, the retired dogs, the injured dogs, and that's who I've got this year. So I've got a whole eight dogs that I'm taking care of, and we sort of rotate them in and out of the house, and they get to go ski during and pulling the kids and those kind of fun activities. I mean, just because they're not racing anymore doesn't mean that their sled dog career is over. Most of these dogs in competitive kennels, they're so well socialized, they transition so well into a home environment, into a recreational environment that they are truly individuals.
But they do need to get out and run sometimes.
They've got an energy level, but I tell you what, they sure learn fast to curl up on the couch.
Zach Steer is our guest today on Talk of Alaska as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. An artist is a person who expresses themselves creatively through words, images, sounds, materials, or original performance. If you are an artist, you might be eligible for funding to support your creative work. March 1st is the deadline to apply for an Individual Artist Award. Visit Rasmussen Foundation on Facebook or on the web at rasmussen.org for more information. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
We're talking Iditarod on Talk of Alaska. Pamela joins the program from Sitka. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Pamela.
Hi, good morning afternoon to both of you. And I have been waiting so long, my thought patterns have changed with the different callers, so now I'm trying to organize what I wanted to say originally. But I'm sure that all the dogs love racing. I mean, any dog, whether it's a poodle or a dog that's been bred for racing, loves it. And I although I don't approve of the Iditarod, I understand that, yes, the dogs really do enjoy it. It's the other however many months that they are chained up. And I heard Zach say that, yeah, he's got the C team, and sometimes they come in on the couches. But I'll bet you most of them don't. They're still chained. Two of the callers mentioned that, it was okay to do that to the Iditarod dogs, but not to other dogs, and that Americans need to stop abusing animals by chaining them up. And I don't understand their point, because people look to the Iditarod as, oh, it's so cool and it's so neat and it's a national sport and gets a lot of attention. So therefore, it's okay to chain your dog when it's not in use. And it's still saying to Americans and everyone in the world that this is an okay thing to do, is to chain your dog. And gosh, they don't mind it because they get to race sometimes. And it's what they're bred to do, and they need to run. But it's the time when they're not running. So I don't understand these other callers saying, yeah, it's okay to do that, just not for other dogs. And I also thought that you were a little rude to the people who didn't agree with you, and I've never heard you be like that on a call-in show that I've listened to. Am I still talking?
Yeah, I was definitely rude to that guy.
I was like, did I push the mute?
No, but I was definitely rude to the guy that wouldn't shut up.
I don't think he could maybe hear you. Sometimes when people get on the phone, they get so hyper, like I am, and excited that they don't quite hear.
Yeah.
But
that's it.
Not that you were rude so much as it's just you're very slanted as pro this. And when the guy was talking to Zach about the dog that he used to own and had ended up in this deplorable condition, you said, you know, to Zach, gosh, you were blindsided by that. But that's what this call-in show is about, the pros and the cons. And I've just never heard you be so pro to something before. And,
well, no, that's just good manners. That was an attack. That's a little bit outside of civility. Well, we just disagree.
Yeah. Yeah, I've just never heard you disagree in so many small ways. But regardless of that, that's my opinion on dog chaining,
okay,
whether it's Iditarod or a poodle.
Well, I think you made your point.
Zach,
quality of life for a dog that's chained. Pamela's saying, and has come up before, you know, just that's no way to keep a dog.
It's a big sticking point for a lot of people that aren't mushers, and honestly, for kennel management, for good kennel management, there really is not a better way to keep, you know, more than 4, 5, 6 dogs without the eventual, you're going to do more harm to the dogs. You're going to have unwanted breedings. You're going to have fights. You're going to have injuries. You're going to have loose dogs killing puppies. You know, it's just not. It's not in the best interest of the dogs. If I had one dog, I'd let it run free all the time. But I don't. I've got 8 dogs now. Some years I've got 30 dogs. It's just the best way to run a professional sled dog kennel.
I can see that. I can see why it's a sticking point too. Telephone number 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. A local call from Anchorage at 550-8422. The subject, Iditarod, the guest, Zach Steer of Sheep Mountain Lodge, and pretty good sport about some of these calls here. Let's go to Dana, joins the program from Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Dana.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for having me on. I just wanted to talk from the perspective of someone that grew up in a mushing family. I appreciate, you know, everybody's view. Everyone has a different view. And I just wanted to mention that, you know, these dogs are really, this is what they love. If you grow up in a mushing family, you see these dogs every day and you see them getting hooked up to go for a run and you see that this is what they want. This is kind of what they were bred to do. And so the way that they're treated by their handlers and their mushers, these are like their babies. So I appreciate everybody's view, but I would just invite people that haven't kind of lived and breathed dog mushing to come to Alaska and, you know, hang out in some of these dog lots and just kind of see how it works and see how the dogs appreciate the work that they're doing for their dog musher. I think, you know, it's different when you just hear about the Iditarod and you hear about the other dog races through the radio or through TV. I think you actually have to kind of see it and live and breathe it to really appreciate and understand the sport in Alaska. The other thing I wanted to mention is that the dog mushing community is really tight-knit, and when there's races in these small communities across Alaska, it really brings everybody together, and it's a way for people to connect and support each other. So I appreciate everybody's view, but I think for people to really understand what it's like, they have to live and breathe it and see it.
Yeah. Okay. Dana, you know, surely you can see the point of the callers that are bringing up about chaining.
Yeah, and I agree with what Zach's point of view is with chaining. You know, if they were loose all the time, there would probably be a lot more problems.
Oh, yeah, but nonetheless, maybe somebody is going to innovate at some point and find some, you know, zoos have had to do this. You know, the Japanese researcher I was talking about, you wouldn't believe the kind of zoo that he's working with now, because that's the ethic now. That's the ethic now. So maybe it may be coming around to a different ethic where there'll have to be some kind of innovations in how kennels are kept. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's rotten apples in every group, whatever organization, whatever sport, you know, in the workplace. And you know we can't be blind that there has been some rotten apple dog mushers in the past, and there's a difference between having proper kennel management and having your dogs on chains, and then there's kennels that have their dogs on chains and the dogs are neglected and they're not fed and they're not cared for, they're not getting the proper vaccinations, they're not getting the feces removed. That's the difference. And what happens is, you know, every once in a while there's a rotten apple that pops up like that, and it casts a really dark shadow on the sport. And I think that in the past, you know, the Iditarod and Mush with Pride and the Quest and a lot of the major sled dog organizations have really worked to self-police and to bring, you know, to set a level of standards of dog care, minimum standards, and two, to educate the mushers, especially, you know, novice mushers and rookie mushers, people that are just getting into the sport that maybe just don't even know any better. Maybe someone that's super excited about being an Iditarod musher but just gets themselves in over their head. You know, that's where we usually see these cases of neglect, and usually it's just it's almost predictable. But if we know how to prevent that, if we can recognize it early enough, you know, we can educate. And I think that's the direction that the sport is going and needs to go.
And do you think culling is a bygone thing now?
Well, I don't think it's bygone. I just, you know, I don't think it's no longer, it's not socially accepted, and it's not really an accepted practice amongst major kennels that I'm aware of. I mean, but I won't say that it doesn't exist.
Yeah, but I mean, if you were talking to another person who was keeping a kennel, would you bring up the subject of culling if you were doing it, or would that be not politically correct?
Well, I mean, I'm sure mushers would discuss it. It's just, things are changing, and that's something that existed in the sport in the not so long ago, but I don't see it. It's not something it's not promoted, and it's not really condoned, and it's not much of an issue as far as I'm aware.
Yeah. Dana, I want to thank you for your call.
Thank you, and good luck to all the mushers.
Yeah, it is something that kind of brings people together. I mean, I got to say it, you know. I'm being accused of being biased, I suppose. In a way, I am. I mean, I'm really interested and ready to explore. But at the same time, you know, I'm an enthusiast. I'm a fan.
You're like Dennis said, you're an Alaska zealot, right?
Yeah. Get my zealot up.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, I look forward to when you get back into the sport, Zach Steer, but it sounds like in a lot of ways you really didn't ever leave.
Well, that's right. I don't think you ever do leave. I mean, and there's so many ways you can be involved in the sport, whether it's at a checkpoint, as a volunteer, as an organizer.
We're out of time.
Yep.
Thanks for talking to us. Thanks to Dave Waldron, Josh Edge. Next week, ethnobotany. You don't know what it is? Well, listen, it's kind of like gardening, kind of.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by Wells Fargo, committed to supporting communities and Alaska residents beyond just their banking needs. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2013 PFD and consider sharing a portion of your dividend through Pick, Click, Give, or contributing to a college savings plan. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska. The Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority was created by the Alaska State Legislature to develop, stimulate, and advance the economic welfare of the state and further the development of public transportation systems. The authority has completed required environmental work to date, and the Federal Highway Administration has given its approval needed to move forward. There's more information at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.